I am indeed Michael Hodges, as advertised. For those of you who've attended my lectures before, I apologize because the preamble is going to be very familiar to you if you've heard me before. I'm the fine arts writer at the Detroit News. In effect, I am the art critic. But these days, you know, now that 12 people put out the Detroit News, we're stretched a little thinner. So basically, I have to write occasionally about any art that takes fine as an adjective. The good news for you tonight was that, you know, the budding author was going to show off and amass just a ton of facts and figures to pistol whip you with through this. But a late-changing Detroit Symphony Orchestra story, nothing that important or at least earth-shaking, but nonetheless ended up consuming much of the day. So what you're going to get is a more anecdotal and conversational presentation of what this particular person happens to find fascinating about Albert Kahn, without an awful lot of figures. So if you could put up with that, we'll all be happy. You know, I've been a reporter most of my life, and it's an incredibly fun kind of disreputable field to be in that I've enjoyed immensely. But I came about 2 inches away from going to architecture graduate school in my late 20s. You know, and instead I landed back into this, which has treated me very well, aside from vanishing under my feet as I approach retirement. But other than that, it's been a great, I mean, really a fun ride. Getting to cover art in particular in a city like Detroit that is suddenly exploding with new excitement and young people actually moving into the city, wow, there's a concept borrowed from other places, has been just dazzling. And the amount of artwork being produced in Detroit is dizzying. And I think some of the quality is very, very good, maybe exceptionally good. We won't know for 50 years, so we'll just have to wait. I blame my architectural interests or obsessions on a couple of things. One is the unbelievably beautiful complex of buildings that constituted our little Rochester Hills dairy farm where I grew up. My dad actually got out of farming when I was 6 years old. My older brothers were lucky enough to be real farm boys. I grew up with the suburbs pressing around us. But at least when I was young, you know, we still had our 3 working barns and the enormous A-framed corn cribs, the chicken coop, the little gas, not a gas station, but the little, like, gas tank out on the edge of the field, on the edge of the barnyard, where we could fill up with our own gasoline. I found that thrilling as a little kid. Can't begin to tell you. Oh, yeah, you think you're cool. We've got our own gas tank. And we had 2 houses, one a sort of larger Cape Cod house that my grandfather, Howard Hodges, renovated when he was completely wiped out in 1929 by the Depression and was only able to hold on to a few of his many investments, which he had paid for on the margin. So, of course, they all disappeared in the crash. But he was able to save this little farm in Rochester, and he rebuilt the main house into kind of a pleasant rambling house, and then there was a little itsy-bitsy house next door that in the 1930s, when you could still get, it's kind of ugly to say, but incredibly cheap farm help, mostly southern farmers who'd been thrown off their farms in the Depression and were moving up north and would work for room and board, and that was it. So in the 30s, that little house was the tenant house, usually with 2 guys and a woman who helped my grandmother and mother cook for everybody. The minute World War II begins to crank up in Europe in 1939, of course, some of which touches this story, all that labor disappears because the car companies start hiring like crazy, even before we get in the war, to supply Britain and France and their orders. And suddenly you can't get anyone. I have friends who used to say, oh, Michael, your dad was a gentleman farmer, and my father, Wallace Hodges, was a distinct gentleman, one of the politest men I've ever known. But he was a dirt farmer. He was a highly educated Phi Beta Kappa from Dartmouth College with a Tuck business degree, dirt farmer. I've always wanted to do an essay for Dartmouth Magazine because I just have a feeling that very few graduates of 1935 like went into dirt farming. I think that was probably a small demographic. In any event, we had these 5 or 6 buildings. The barn buildings were all beautiful red Victorian barns. We had two silos. They formed a sort of public square, I like to think, a sort of piazza. That's my earliest sense that there was something magic about the way you group buildings, and that the way buildings are grouped and organized can make you feel as comfortable as in a lovely kitchen, or, as is too often the case in this country, kind of uncomfortable and, like, you know, not really sure what's going on around you. And that stamp, that sense of protection, always stayed with me. The other thing I blame is I spent 6 years at the what used to be called the Cranbrook School for Boys, which I maintain is one of North America's most beautiful and perfect little campuses. I just don't think it gets much better, particularly much better than the boys' school, the Red Brick Arts and Crafts part, which is the largest and the most complex, kind of in urbanist terms. So in any event, I blame those for the fact that I'm always looking and criticizing buildings and arrangement of buildings. So this book, no, I don't have an Albert Kahn book to sell you, I'm so sorry. I've got my train station book that I've been peddling for a couple of years. Here's what the book project is. I like writing books, I've written one so far, aimed at a general intelligent audience who may or may not have ever given architecture a second thought. When my train station book came out, Wayne State University brought it out. Lovely people to work with, just lovely. And really, their list on Detroit and Michigan subjects is the most interesting of the academic presses that I know in Michigan. No disrespect to the U of M press, but Wayne is really aimed for sort of a general reader in many respects, and that's been lovely. In any event, so they brought out my train station book, which was a great pleasure, and then I came back to them with subsequent proposals, and they bit on the Albert Kahn proposal. This is not going to come out probably until early 2017. As I keep saying, my deadline is 13 months away, all right? Get off my back. When you're a writer and maybe not the most organizationally gifted person on the planet, you go through rolling waves of panic as you approach your deadline. These are good things. This is healthy. It's only the panic that motivates me. And I was bragging to friends 6 months ago that I was panicking 18 months in advance, and that was great. But now I'm rather closer and still panicked. I have read a prodigious amount, it seems, for this, some 12 books. Fascinating looks at Kahn and Detroit and Kahn's influence on worldwide architecture, which is rather underappreciated. So what's interesting about Albert Kahn in sort of the most black and white, simple, maybe even overstated ways? One is that he's an incredible success story. As I'll detail in a minute, he arrives in these shores with an incredibly poor Jewish family who moved here from Luxembourg. They're from Germany originally. They had that family that he grew up with had no economic success until Albert was able to get on his feet. And then, as was the story of so many immigrant families in the 20s, well, before the 20s, the teens, 20s and 30s, lifted the family up into affluence and great success. Albert Kahn, you can make the argument, there are a couple of other contenders, but he's one of two or three contenders for the title of the inventor of the daylight factory, the modern factory. The move from sort of cramped, dark, poorly ventilated, poorly lit factories with columns every 20 feet to these wide open spaces filled, a little bit like Gothic cathedrals, with glass taking up as much of the wall space as humanly possible. Because he is one of the very early inventors of the daylight factory, and the factories that he built for Packard and then Ford and then virtually every car company in the United States, these were huge buildings and complexes by comparison to earlier models. And from Europe, and the European side of the story is interesting and important, from a European viewpoint, in 1905, when the Packard plant is built, or 1910, when Highland Park is built, The American factories seemed unbelievably large, just stupendous. Europe catches up with us in the size and grandeur department industrially, but at the turn of the 20th century, they were still a continent of small shops and medium-sized outfits. And here we were birthing these tremendous industrial combines, and Albert Kahn was building the factories for most of them. So because of that, he's regarded as a foundation stone of modern architecture. The Packard plant in particular is a, and we will see this in a minute, is a stripped down, super simple, no frills design. Every step taken to save the owner money, to be as efficient as humanly possible given the knowledge in 1905. That and then the Highland Park factory become the inspiration, many argue now, for the international style in Europe, which eventually jumps over to this country after World War II in a big way and becomes the modern style that we know everywhere, the simple, geometric, unadorned, exposed structural style that now so dominates life in this century that we don't even notice it anymore. But it came from someplace, and somebody had to sketch out and build the first archetypes that would cause the Europeans, this is a bit of an overstatement, but to fall on their knees with their arms wide spread, crying, yay, yay, we have seen the future, and it is Albert Kahn. And also some grain elevators in Canada and Minnesota and Buenos Aires. The Europeans were struck by the magnitude and the sculptural simplicity of the great industrial buildings that were going up in the New World. Another reason, this is reason four why Albert Kahn is important and why we should care about him. He, and this is a little truer, he saved the Diego Rivera murals at the Detroit Institute of Arts. Again, this is an overstatement. Actually, it's Edsel Ford who, several months after they are unveiled, is interviewed and says that he was perfectly happy with the murals and he felt that, you know, Diego Rivera had captured the spirit of the automotive culture in Detroit, and that put an end, mostly, to the vicious, mostly extraordinarily conservative and religious attacks on the Detroit Institute in industry murals at the DIA. What Kahn does is kind of moving. Kahn is an arts commissioner. That is, he's on the board that governs the DIA for the city. The DIA, of course, was actually a city department in those years. Edsel Ford is the head of the arts commission. 3 days after the murals are unveiled, when the attacks are just beginning to take shape, Albert Kahn, in my newspaper, I'm very happy to say that we buried him on page 11A, I'm a little embarrassed to say, becomes, and we, my paper was dead set against the murals, thought they were the worst thing since who knows what, communistic, anti-Christian, you name it. But Kahn, in a first-person essay, writes that we Detroiters should be grateful for Mr. Rivera, that he has put Detroit on the artistic map, and in the sharp, in the avuncular, just ever so slightly sharp tone that he occasionally got in some of his more impassioned arguments, he basically said anyone who didn't recognize that needed to open their eyes. Here's my theory. I can't prove this. I haven't done the research in the Edsel Ford archives yet. It may be that there's an answer. But I still think that Albert Kahn, very famous architect and businessman in downtown Detroit, standing right up and saying publicly, both helped Edsel Ford then to endorse them without equivocation a month or two later, and may well have saved them. You will recall what happened in New York City, fancy-pantsy New York. I adore New York. I'm so not criticizing New York. I moved here from New York. But in New York City, of course, the Rockefeller Center mural gets not just whitewashed. That doesn't work very well with tempura anyhow, where the pigment is soaked into the plaster, not just painted over, but smashed off the walls of Rockefeller Center because Rivera foolishly, who was a communist who had fallen out of grace with the Mexican Communist Party because he kept working for rich people, like Edsel Ford, who commissioned the Detroit industry murals, he paints Lenin into the New York City Rockefeller Center mural. That was not in the sketch that he submitted to the Rockefellers. And I think the Rockefellers were ticked, but interestingly, it's actually the building management at Rockefeller Center, which would be like a subcontractor employed, I guess, by the Rockefellers. They're the ones that say that SOB's work has to go, and they smash it off the walls. So let's just stand back and recognize once again, pokey provincial Detroit saves its murals. Now, we didn't have Vladimir Lenin, but we do have a worker wearing a glove with a big red star on it. We do have the vaccination thing in the upper right-hand corner of one of the walls that Father Coughlin, the radio priest, and the others said was defamatory to, you know, the manger scene, upon which it was, of course, very clearly based. Pokey little Detroit saves its murals. New York destroys theirs. I think there's a lesson in there. I'm not sure what it is, but I like it. And finally, this is reason number five why we should care about Albert Kahn, apart from the fact that he was a lovely-seeming guy. I've read, I'm about three-quarters of the way through the Kahn archives at the Bentley Historical Library at the university, and let me salute the Bentley. They've been just lovely people to work with, and the archives are magnificent. But I've read an awful lot of letters from Albert Kahn, not tragically as many as I would have liked. There was a fire, apparently, in the very early 40s in the Kahn offices in Detroit. A lot of files get lost. The letters that are left are almost exclusively letters of commendation. They're routine things that an architect like Kahn would do. He would ask happy clients, like, say, Henry Joy at Packard Motor Company, to write a letter endorsing him for another project. And so there's this parade of letters from super famous Detroiters endorsing Albert Kahn. Henry Ford's was very terse. It was about eight words long, but it nonetheless was very complimentary. And then there are a few letters from Albert himself in that file, very few, and they're very narrowly focused. I would give my eye teeth to discover that there had been a diary that he kept. I think the truth is that Albert Kahn was far too practical and far too busy. He famously would sleep on drafting boards at work if he had to work super late, or so the story goes. I think he was just far too practical, too much a man of his era to be keeping an introspective journal. But I would pay him now, if I could, $10,000. I'm going to do a Kickstarter or an Indiegogo campaign. You know, I'm going to raise some money. So in any event, he seems to have been just this lovely person. Some of his letters to one of his daughters in particular, when she was in boarding school and then in college, are just deeply affecting letters. It's an incredibly affectionate, sweet-seeming guy who was very big on Detroit and Detroit's potential to be a great, great city. He predicted, sure as I'm standing here, we will have a subway in Detroit. God grant that he'd been right there, because I don't think Detroit would look anything like it does today had that been the case. In any event, reason number five why we care about Albert Kahn, he won World War II for the Allies. A Jewish boy from Detroit. There's some lovely grace in that. And we will come to that in a minute. Yet, Kahn, for all these accomplishments, inventing modern architecture, inventing the Daylight Factory, saving the Rivera murals, all right, that's a local concern, winning World War II, everyone cares about that, he's virtually disappeared from the architectural canon. He's very hard to find in a lot of the standard texts that came out, especially 30 or 40 years ago. He has come in for reappraisal here and there. I think that he is much better known now than he was maybe 25 years ago. I'm just guessing there. But it's an interesting phenomenon because he really has kind of vanished outside of Michigan. How can this be? One problem is that while he may have invented the stripped-down geometric style of architecture that has come to be known as the international style or modernism, he sort of disavowed his child because his feeling was that, generally speaking, very stripped-down, unornamented buildings, especially like Packard, were inappropriate. An inappropriate style and approach for houses or skyscrapers or academic buildings. had he seen some of the work of, say, Mies van der Rohe, who paid attention to Albert Kahn, he might have felt differently. But a lot of the early 1920s modernist work by Gropius and Le Corbusier and Mendelssohn and others in Europe, he found odd-looking and revolutionary for the simple sake of being revolutionary, with windows placed in odd places way too close to corners and this and that. So he criticizes the men who become the gods of 20th century architecture. Walter Gropius, you know, is in Germany. He's the Bauhaus founder. He's one of the early protean figures in international style architecture. He eventually takes over Harvard Architecture School. So, I mean, he lodges himself here. Le Corbusier, you know, becomes just enormously influential. And Kahn, in writing, had sharp things to say about the work of these men, rather sharp things. It's so interesting, though, and I think it says a lot about the individual himself. When Gropius finally came to the United States in the mid-30s and came to Cranbrook, where he gave an address, Kahn escorted him around Detroit and, according to the news accounts I've read, could not have been more gracious, was just a lovely host. So kind to Walter Gropius. His only disappointment was that Walter Gropius was only interested in his factories and did not consider the Fisher Building a building of much merit. Because, of course, Walter Gropius was, you know, a revolutionary modernist, and the Fisher Building is Art Deco of a sort. It's not modern 20th century architecture. It's early modern architecture, if you want, and it is too heavy with historical references and, you know, images, faces, and whatnot. It's not stripped down. All right, so he criticizes the new lords of architecture. That didn't go over well with the emerging consensus in architecture schools in the United States in the 20s and 30s. In the early 30s, I believe it's the early 30s, there's an exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art, MoMA, in New York, and the exact title escapes me, but it was in effect The Origins of the International Style, and they pointed to these sort of, you know, predecessors of the international style. I can't remember if the grain silos of the New World were included, but Albert Kahn is not included. He's not mentioned. There's not an image, despite the fact that Walter Gropius in 1913 publishes an essay on industrial works in the New World in a German architecture journal that includes a picture of the Highland Park plant, the 1910 Ford Motor Company Highland Park plant on Woodward Avenue and Manchester Avenue, clearly suggesting that this was something that was being worked into his own designs. And while Walter Gropius is designing the Fagerswerk plant, or Fagerswerk, I'm never quite sure how my German should go, it is reported on very good authority by the architectural critic Rainer Bonham, that Gropius had a picture of the Highland Park plant above his drafting table. Amusingly, Le Corbusier, the great Frenchman, when he publishes, I think in 1920, I think it was actually a book of sort of precedents of modernist architecture, he includes a picture of Highland Park, but he disapproved of the fact that, unlike the Packard plant, which was completely stripped down and utilitarian in aspect, the Highland Park plant had a little bit of decorative brickwork, especially up at the tops and the towers and whatnot. Le Corbusier photoshopped that out. I got 100 years before Photoshop, but he takes that off. He also doesn't identify the architect, which seems to me to just be bad manners. So Kahn doesn't see the application of what, in fact, he has created to architecture generally, although he was very proud of his factory buildings and called them beautiful. Kahn was also colorblind. This is just such idiotic, you know, psych 101 BS, but it's just the not seeing the application of his factory design to a wider architectural vocabulary reminds me a little bit somehow of colorblindness. The interesting thing is that had Kahn been a champion of applying this design style to buildings generally, I think that he would be super-duper famous now. But in this respect, he was very much a traditionalist. And I think there are interesting reasons why. Notably that he basically became an architect by apprenticing to various art, well, to two architects in particular. He did not go to architecture graduate school. He didn't graduate from high school. He stopped school when he arrived in the United States at age 11 in 1880. But he works in architects' offices from there on, and he learns it that way. Whether or not that has some influence on maybe a greater reverence for traditional forms or for the vocabulary that his mentor, George Mason, espoused, you know, who knows? All right. Three other things that interest me in the decline in his relative visibility. One is that he is best known as an industrial architect. He built vast amounts of industrial plant. And industry doesn't enjoy anywhere near the prestige today that it did in 1930. You know, there was a time when we didn't think of pollution. I mean, factories emitting smoke were regularly pictured in drawings and photographs because that was progress, that was hope, that was prosperity. We live in a very different era. I think that Kahn has also suffered from the collapse of the reputation of the city of Detroit and the collapse of reverence that Americans used to have for the auto industry before it started to stumble in the 1970s. So I think to some extent, the architect and his fame worldwide are affected by where he worked and the type of design, the industrial work that he did. Not that other architects would regard the industrial work in the 20th century as being anything to be ashamed of, quite the contrary. But the culture has a different point of view. Finally, this is number five, and then we'll start going through pictures, which are infinitely more interesting than what I can say. But I looked up rather late in the game. I looked up obits in the three Detroit papers, the Free Press, the News, and the old late lamented Detroit Times. When the Detroit Times went belly up, the Detroit News somehow acquired its furniture, and for years I worked at a table on the fifth floor of the old Detroit News building, hello, a 1915 Albert Kahn building. I worked at this huge steel gray metal desk that had a little silver tag on it that said property of Detroit Times. I wanted to try to pry that off in the worst way before we moved out of our building, but I didn't get around to it. In any event, the obits, Albert Kahn dies December 8th, 1942. It's a year and a day after the attack on Pearl Harbor. His firm is building zillions of Air Force, Army, and Navy plants around the continent and to some extent the world. The obits in the papers and the obit issue in the publication put out by the Michigan Society of Architects, because they did a memorial issue for him, they all focus on the war work. I think it's either the Free Press or the News gives his commercial and academic buildings at the university and in Detroit like a paragraph. There's just a little list. Everything is about what he's doing to defeat Hitler and Japan. And if we move ourselves back to 1942, that makes sense. This is very early in the war. We are not winning in 1942, let me assure you. We are getting our butts kicked, particularly in the Pacific. Nothing would have seemed more important to obit writers and memorializers than the urgent work that this great architect was doing to save the world from, you know, the enemy. But when you move up 50 years, we know we won the war, and so all this praise about, you know, the bases here and the plants there that were all turned to war work is a little immaterial to a modern audience. But, and I think this has something to do with how my industry frames the first edition of history. What do you look up if you're starting to look up articles on somebody dead? You look up their obit. And the obit said Albert Kahn did nothing except war work and industrial buildings related to war work. I mean, there's just Paul Philippe Cray, who designs the Detroit Institute of Arts, writes a full-page memorial to Conant. I was so excited because I thought he'll say what he thinks about some of the buildings he really likes, but he doesn't. It's all about the war work. So I think that also has tended to close in appreciation for Conant, because for those high school students and college students that did look stuff up in the newspapers, this is what they were told. And there's no summary accounting thereafter of his non-industrial design, at least not for many years. Some books come out in the 60s and 70s that are fairly good. There's a particularly good one, Albert Kahn, Architect of Ford, by the head of the architecture department at the University of Milan in Italy, a fellow named Federico Bucci. It's a great book. There's also a book by Grant Hildebrand, which I believe is Designing for Industry, Albert Kahn. I might have the name just slightly wrong. It's a very interesting biography. But generally speaking, and Ada Louise Huxtable, one of my favorite architectural critics from the New York Times many years ago, she wrote several pieces for, I think it was Architectural Forum in the early 60s, kind of resurrecting Kahn, almost to say, dear Lord, what have we forgotten? What have we overlooked? If I were to characterize what I like about Kahn's style and his impact on Detroit and Ann Arbor, his stuff, especially at the University of Michigan, when you think of like Hill Auditorium and even Burton Memorial Tower, it's kind of, he has this heavy, masculine, kind of stolid look to a lot of his work, whether it's Art Deco, whether it's a Sullivan-esque in the manner of, you know, the great architect Sullivan, as with Hill Auditorium, or in the style of architects he deeply admired, the great architects of the very early 20th century, late 19th century, McKim, Mead, and White, which we see echoed perhaps in his Detroit Savings Bank, Kitty Corner from my new fabulous offices right downtown by Campus Martius, or even in Angel Hall. He didn't, by the way, dismiss all European modernists. An early European modernist who actually trained Walter Gropius, or for whom Gropius worked, Peter Behrens. He liked a lot of Behrens' work, but the early Behrens' work is not as stripped and mechanical looking as some of Gropius's and Le Corbusier's. Kahn also designed in no single style, and this is not a good thing in 20th century architecture. This is considered to be a very bad, sloppy thing, as if you have no focus. Another architect who got savaged in print for this was Eero Saarinen, you know, the great modernist, the son of the designer of Cranbrook, Eliel Saarinen. And the rap against him, Vincent Scully, the Yale professor and architecture critic, accused him of branding buildings, that each of his headquarters for various corporate entities in the United States, everyone looked completely different from another, as if it was mere advertising. I interviewed Scully, by the way, who said awful things about the TWA terminal at Kennedy, like, hello, how is that possible? And I interviewed him like 5 or 6 years ago for I don't remember what reason, and he said, well, he thought he'd been a little hard on Eero Saarinen, actually, and he really did kind of like the TWA terminal now, but, you know, what was he going to do? It was all in the past. Hold on, let me just find where I was. Okay, so he designs in no single style. This really gets held against you. You're supposed to, in 20th century modernism, you have a very distinct focus. You cultivate that focus. You don't veer from it. He was also willing to do industrial and commercial work, although, as I say, industry had a pretty good standing with European modernists. Kahn himself says that he started doing industrial stuff early in the 20th century, because at that time, other architects wouldn't touch it, but that changes. All right, so he dies in 1942. I have just some, like, random personal notes here. His parents were Joseph and Rosalie, a rabbi, an itinerant rabbi, who, in this country, had to work at any number of odd jobs and sort of petty business jobs that were way beneath, I'm sure, his talents. It was the classic thing. The parents bring the children over. The parents have to work their fannies off at dreadful jobs, way beneath their sort of cultural level and whatnot in education. But they managed to hold the family together and to provide at least a very good foundation, apparently. By the way, Kahn, before he arrives in this country, in Luxembourg, was regarded as something of a prodigy with the piano, though an early sign, perhaps, of genius in another creative realm. But at one point he decided that he was never going to be great, and so he mostly stops pursuing it. And, of course, again, once he gets to this country, he's not going to school. You know, he's not taking piano lessons. He gets apprenticed very quickly on his arrival here to, I'm not quite certain of the precise age, to John L. Scott, the architect who built the Wayne County Courthouse. That's the one with the great statuary on top of the galloping triumphant horses and whatnot that kind of faces Campus Martius. John Scott also designed most of the houses in the Inn on Ferry Street, that adorable little boutique hotel of four or five mini mansions on Ferry, just north of the Detroit Institute of Arts. If anyone has friends coming who want to stay in downtown Detroit, they should stay at the Inn on Ferry Street, the central house where you register. Whoa! Was my great-grandparents' house. I'm just saying. 84 East Ferry. We were something in this town before the Great Depression wiped my grandfather out. He gets apprenticed to John Scott. He works for John Scott. He gets fired by John Scott because he smells. Kahn, this is an index of poverty and also ambition. Kahn had taken a job early in the morning, one imagines around dawn, brushing down two horses for some wealthier person. He arrives at the John Scott offices smelling like horses. And as he said many years later, I think it was in a speech honoring George Mason after the Masonic Temple that Mason built opened in Detroit, Kahn said that basically bathing opportunities and a second change of clothes were luxuries that were hard to come by in his household. He's very lucky, though, because he falls under the influence of the artist Julius Melchers, whose son Gary Melchers is much more famous. But Julius Melchers gave drawing lessons on the weekends, and he gives them to Kahn for free. He sees in the young man, you know, whatever, and discovers, in fact, that he's very good with chalk and a pencil. And it's through Melchers that ultimately Kahn lands at the architecture firm that we know most by the name Mason and Rice, where he's taken under the wing of another benevolent, somewhat older, not that much older guy, George Mason, the architect. George Mason, who built Masonic Temple, George Mason, who built the Chelsea train station, such a sweet little exercise, George Mason, who also built the Grand Hotel in Mackinac. The porch is attributed by some people to Albert Kahn. I've read that many places. I haven't nailed it down. I'm seeing a knowledgeable head nodding, so that's good, which is a lovely thing because, among other things, it means I have to go to Mackinac and shoot the porch. Yes. And I'm not going to pay the $10 either. George Mason repeatedly invites the young Kahn, who's a teenager, I presume, in these years, to his house for dinner and to just rifle through Mason's library, which Kahn does. This is how Kahn becomes an architect. It's really kind of wonderful. In 1890, at 21 years of age, Kahn wins $500 for a traveling scholarship from the American Architect and Building News. Nobody else applied for it that year, but that takes nothing away from Albert Kahn for winning it. And he goes to Europe for a year. Interestingly, every single obituary in the Detroit paper said, and he traveled for 2 years on a fellowship, an artistic fellowship. It's like, he was a very poor man. He couldn't go away for 2 years. $500 doesn't take you that far. What he did do was he traveled for part of that with Henry Bacon, the designer of the Lincoln Memorial. Henry Bacon was young. This is pre-Lincoln Memorial. Bacon was on a $1,500 two-year traveling scholarship, so we assume that my predecessors at the city desk got confused by those two things. But Kahn is able to go and spend a year in Germany and Italy and Belgium and everywhere sketching like mad, beautiful sketches, some of which I believe are at Bentley and a number of which are at the University of Michigan Museum of Art. All right, at this point, I think we can actually, this is Albert Kahn. Does he not look like a nice guy? I'm very serious. Just bouncing back to the Diego Rivera thing, I love the fact that he posed with them. And there's also a suggestion that he invited them out to the lovely country house that he had built on Walnut Lake. And I love the idea of him hobnobbing with the Mexican, you know, communists. Let's see. So one of his first big commissions, when he's working for George Mason, he does a lot of work on houses. But in 1903, he and his brother Julius Kahn build the engineering building at the University of Michigan. And this is one of the buildings where I don't yet have really book-ready pictures. I have okay pictures. The interesting thing about this is that he builds this using reinforced concrete. The advantage of reinforced concrete as opposed to traditional mill construction is that the steel members, which are placed inside the concrete and solidifies around them, they strengthen it so that you can have much wider spans between supports or between walls or columns. This is one of the ways that the daylight factory is invented, is reinforced concrete enables Kahn to suddenly design what at the time were stupefyingly large open rooms without columns all over the place. In 1905, Kahn gets hired to do the Packard plant, and that the reinforced concrete thing always comes up with Packard. And you will hear a lot of people say, oh, the Kahn brothers invented reinforced concrete in Detroit, period. And that's just not true. Actually, a parade of French engineers invented the concept of reinforced concrete in the 19th century. Nonetheless, the Kahn method, as it became known, was a particularly effective and I suspect a very economical method. His brother Julius is actually really the one credited with all of this, but the two worked sort of hand in glove. All of Kahn's brothers end up one way or another either working with him or working at the firm. Julius ends up founding his own reinforced concrete firm called the Trust Concrete Company, later shortened to TrustCon. One of the things I like, though, about the engineering building, what we now call West Engineering, at the corner of the Diag, it's not just the reinforced concrete, lovely and interesting though that is, I love the arch. And here's one of my arguments about Albert Kahn's work. And this doesn't happen to every architect, even skilled ones. Three or four or five of his buildings have become iconic buildings, buildings that define certain places, buildings that have a radiance or power that exceeds their actual qualities, perhaps. Engineering does because we all walk through that arch. And walking through a compressed space like an arch, we don't quite recognize it, but it is an architectural experience that leaves something with us. And so even though many people might deride this building as kind of unimaginative and drawing on stale historic imagery and whatnot, I disagree. I think it's a lovely building. But the archway makes it something not magical, but special at least. Another building like that that we will look at is the Fisher Building, which for everyone who lives in Oakland County is Detroit, period. I encourage them to go farther downtown. I grew up in Oakland County. I know what it feels like. And the backside of the engineering building is kind of characteristic of a lot of the stuff that he builds at the university, particularly like natural sciences, which is one of his, which is to say it's not factory design, but it's very simple. And by the standards of 1903, this is a stripped down, largely unornamented building. It looks very ornamented to us, of course. But it has some of the simplicity that he is bringing or will bring to factory design. This is 1904. We're going chronologically. I thought this would be a fun way to get a sense of sort of the variety of what he does. This is the Anna Scripps Conservatory on Belle Isle, which I had never seen until I went to photograph it 3 months ago. I mean, I grew up here, and I just never had quite seen this little corner of Belle Isle. And I think it's just beautiful building, just breathtaking. And I swear, I still think, I mean, glass buildings always suggest this, but there's something modernist in there. The building has been much altered. It used to have more decorative whatnot on the ground floor. And it was modernized at some point in the mid to late 20th century, so it doesn't look quite like it did originally, but I still think it's just about as gorgeous as it can be. And it's attached, of course, to the aquarium building, and this is the only picture I have right now of the aquarium because all my other ones sucked. The aquarium is especially gorgeous inside, where it's all this kind of slick green bathroom tile, but beautiful bathroom tile on every inch. It's gorgeous. I can't wait to photograph in there. I'm very excited about that. So 1905, Albert Kahn in 1903 does work on the house of Henry Joy, who becomes the manager, the head of Packard Motor Company, and hires Albert Kahn, who has only done residential work for him. This is very amusing. And says, you know, I think you can do a factory, kid. I think you can do one fine. And so he builds Packard, which is the sprawling half mile long, I have measured it driving from end to end, parade of mostly identical six or seven story buildings that march along wee little Concord Street, and in the process vault across Grand Boulevard with the famous bridge that goes across. It's interesting, too, you look at the what remains of the little cottages on Concord right across the street from this. I mean, right across the street. And these buildings were not set back from the sidewalk. They were right at the sidewalk. Little one-and-a-half-story cottages. And you can sort of imagine that in 1906, it would have been a lovely life. I live in this beautiful little cottage that was just built, and I walk 50 feet across the street to work in this glistening, gleaming new factory. Unfortunately, of course, in the modern era, it doesn't stay gleaming and glistening. And much of the Packard plant is now lost. It's, you know, heroic reinforced concrete notwithstanding. The up-to-the-minute story on the Packard plant is that it has been purchased. I believe it was for $500,000 a year or two ago at auction by a Spanish developer by the name of Palazuelo, who has been extraordinarily successful doing historic renovation on large stuff in Lima, Peru. And he bought this and has insisted that he is going to build an apartment there for himself in one of the existing structures, and that he will progressively rehab the structures for use as residential, commercial, and possibly light industrial work. We can only pray. It still seems to me, you know, Packard is way east. It's way east. You know, it's far enough east that a lot of people begin to get a little scared and alarmed that they've overshot and who knows where in the world they are. And it's in a very sad neighborhood. It's a little hard to believe that even souped up to the gills that it's going to attract the sort of traffic and visits that would be necessary to float residential and commercial stuff in that part of the city, but man, fingers crossed. I can't say enough about the effort. This is the backside of the plant. I think this is the west side, you know, the setting sun. And this is basically what you had. You had these sort of module buildings that went on and on and on and on and on. And then there are just these little architectural details like this bridge connection between two of those five or six story buildings with the water tower. I don't care if water towers are trite. I am such a sucker for urban iconography of that sort. I mean, I just think this is a heartbreakingly beautiful little thing, especially the way in there you have these shattered pieces of glasses that are just catching little bits of light. I just think it's like there's... What I like about early 20th century architecture is that it's much more geometric than what we know. I mean, industry now gets built in huge, big box stores, basically. It makes sense. But early 20th century architectural stuff, I don't think I have a good picture here from the Packard plant, but they drew on lots of precedents, some of them agricultural in look, and that there's just a geometry to the plant design that gives it a much more human face than what we see today. Okay, this is 1908, so we've done 1905 Packard plant. And building number 10, the first reinforced concrete building at Packard and in Detroit. And then we move on to the Booth House at Cranbrook, which is this wonderful, just lovely exercise in arts and crafts, English, woohoo, built on the Cranbrook campus. It's the only significant old building on the Cranbrook campus, well, it's one of two significant old buildings on the Cranbrook campus that was not designed and built by Eliel Saarinen, who, by the way, was a friend of Albert Kahn's, and Albert Kahn did not feel in any sense that I can tell, you know, cheated for not having been given the commission to build Cranbrook, because Albert Kahn's interests went in so many other directions. And Cranbrook, of course, for Saarinen, was a life-consuming exercise. I mean, that's all he did once he got here, pretty much. And some buildings in Fenton, oddly, some kind of lovely buildings. So I have to get back to Cranbrook. This was originally the Booth House, now we call it Cranbrook House. I want to photograph the interior during Christmas. I also want to hit the Edsel and Eleanor Ford House in Grosse Pointe Shores, which I have not yet photographed, but I have a lot of revisiting to do here. So here we are, it's 1910, and we're building the Highland Park plant on Woodward Avenue and Manchester Avenue. In Highland Park, which I do not need to tell you people is one of those amusing little freestanding independent municipalities within the city of Detroit. There are two, it and Hamtramck. And this is where the lion's share of Model Ts roll out. had I had a little more time today, I would have that figure, but you can Google it. Mr. Google knows everything. You can see, though, at the far end on the right, we have a CVS pharmacy, and there's this... How can I put this gently? Highland Park is one of the poorest places on planet Earth. It's desperate for commerce of ordinary stuff that we take for granted. And somebody at some point in the 80s, I think, or early 90s, built this Model T plaza that has the CVS and a number of other big box stores and sneaker stores and whatnot on both sides of Woodward Avenue. The commerce that extends to the locals is great and really, really a good thing, but it's just, forgive me, this is a technical term, the French use it, but ugly. It's just the worst of sort of strip mall architecture tarted up to look kind of impressive. They tried to imitate some of the roofline features on factories behind it. Maybe Albert Kahn factories, may not be, I'm not sure, because most of Highland Park has disappeared. But it all just looks kind of trite and silly. That said, even in their dilapidation, and I think this again says something about the architect, that the remaining buildings, this is the administration building on the right, it's the fancier one, and in back of it is the annex that was attached to, I believe, the six-story building or the original building. There are all these names. In any event, the left-hand thing is a small annex that was added to an 860-foot-long, chew on that for a minute when you think of the scale of new industry in 1910, 860-foot-long, I believe 6-foot-story building that extended way down Manchester Avenue just off Woodward, and the annex is the only surviving part because, of course, the 860 feet is where the CVS sits. But we can see here elements that we see with Packard, and we begin to understand, you know, why this wowed the Europeans so much. While it's true that there's a little bit of brick ornamentation, especially in the building on the right, which was supposed to have ornamentation, it was not a factory. It was the administration building, and there was a showroom on the ground floor where you could buy your damn Model T and drive out. But the buildings behind were the factory buildings. And despite a little bit of ornamentation on the tower on the left, basically what you have is floor slab, wall slabs, and glass, filling up everything in between. So you have here the birth of modern architecture in many ways. You have, I mean, this is Mies van der Rohe. This is Richard Meier. This is stuff which since has been done brilliantly and done very, 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 very badly. And it was pictures of this, which, again, animated Walter Gropius, and which he kept on his desk while designing and also then wrote about. Here's a close-up picture. It's just, I mean, the stores are doing good work. You know, it's God bless them, but Lord. But still, I mean, in its way, this is the administration building, of course. I mean, look, there's decorative tile along the cornice. But just still sort of lovely, even in its near collapse. There is a nonprofit group which has acquired this building. I think it's the Friends of Woodward Avenue. And they are trying to do heroic work to bring it back. The National Park Service has always been interested in it as some sort of National Historic Site. It is a National Historic Site. It's just not fixed up. So we can at least cross our fingers that given the astonishing number of abandoned buildings in Detroit that are suddenly, like, living and breathing and beautiful again, we can hope that that happens here. We can also hope they tear down the shopping plaza and put in, I don't know, cool housing, multi-story housing or something. Again, the Daylight Factory, you bring in as much light as humanly possible, and you can sort of see looking through this, which I think is the annex again, but the amount of light that would come in. Both Henry Ford and Albert Kahn were very interested in factories that would be humane places to work. Albert Kahn, I think, because as an architect, he had that sort of idealism that you want people to be as healthy and happy in your buildings as humanly possible. This means light. This means adequate thought to ventilation. You know, releasing the hot air through the, what are they called, monitors, the open skylights on the ceiling, et cetera, et cetera. Henry Ford felt much the same, though Henry Ford had the ulterior motive that he wanted to cram as many people into that daylight factory as humanly possible, and did, and bragged about it. But, it, I mean, people had very little room working at these prodigious machines. But the light and the ventilation facilitated that, and in 1910, were revolutionary. Just jaw-droppingly revolutionary. So revolutionary, again, that Europeans picked up the idea. Now, this is not Walter Gropius. This is the Fiat, the original huge, well, not the first, but one of the original huge Fiat factories in Turin or Torino, Italy, where I was just 6 weeks ago taking this picture. And what you can see is the similarity in the fact that the window fills up everything. Now, this is painted white, or at least it's all monochromatic. So, but basically what you've got is floor slabs and wall dividers, and that's about it. And that comes from this. And Matteo Trucco, the Italian engineer who designed the Fiat Lingotto factory, it's Lingotto is the part of Turin that it's in. It's at the end of their elegant little subway line. It's really very nice. He was very clear that, in fact, he had seen Albert Kahn's work and that this was an inspiration for this huge factory. This, by the way, gets designed in the mid-teens and isn't really complete and working until about 1920. The Highland Park plant that it's based on is considered by both Kahn and Ford obsolete by 1914. Because they began to realize there were bits of the moving assembly part at Highland Park, but just little bits. It was a multi-story building. And that was when the great revelation came to probably Ford first, but I'm not sure, that no, everything needs to be on one floor for a fully functioning moving production line. Now, here's what I love about European appropriation of American precedents in early modernist architecture at the turn of the 20th century. The Kahn Highland Park plant, six stories tall. The way it worked is the raw materials were brought into the roof. And as they were assembled, and these were mostly gears and bits, they weren't bringing raw iron ore up there. That would happen later at the Rouge complex. But they were bringing up little bits of cars. As they fell through the six stories, they assumed shape and became a car, until at the very bottom, a fully finished Model T emerged. Well, almost fully finished, it would drive out, and then they would put the body on it outside of the building. Both Ford and Kahn were excited by the use of gravity as a way of moving things around without having to use electricity. Here's what the Europeans did, God bless them. They built Fiat Lingotto, and the raw materials came in on the ground floor. And they rose, thanks to electricity. I can hear Albert Kahn saying, you know, that costs money. They rose up through the plant, becoming bigger and bigger bits of a Fiat, until they emerged on the top floor, fully formed as an automobile, and there was a racetrack up there, and they'd zip around the racetrack. Tragically, I didn't rip off a picture of the racetrack from Mr. Google. I am so sorry. I intended to. But it's just, I mean, it's the most lovely, elegant, almost silly thing. And it says something about at least how I view, in my completely ill-informed way, what Europeans did with the images they saw in American early industrial architecture. They took them and prettified them. They took them and made them styled. They took a completely practical approach to factory building and turned it into an aesthetic, which Albert Kahn would probably not have done. This, by the way, though, there's one fabulous thing about the Fiat Lingotto factory. By the way, you remember what the Highland Park plant looks like now. This is an upscale shopping mall. I mean, it's fabulous. I am dreadful at interior photography, and my pictures of the elegant stores lining all these hallways didn't come out well. But it was repurposed by the marvelous Italian architect Renzo Piano into a luxury hotel and then a shopping mall. And it was full of conventioners. It was actually very cool. This, you know, if you assemble a car as it rises until it gets to the racetrack on top, you need some sort of system to bring it down, right? Unless you're just going to elevator it. So Truco built this double helix winding roadway down from the roof, a double helix because there's one of these things at one end and at the other. And I have to say, I love this. I don't care if it was foolish. I don't care if they wasted electricity getting the damn cars up to the top. This alone was worth visiting this factory. This is Fagus or Fagusverk, Walter Gropius. This is being designed shortly after Highland Park opens up in 1910. So this, I think, is finished in 1913. And you can see that this is very pretty. I wanted to go up to Germany to shoot this so bad I could taste it. But getting from Turin, Italy, to Hanover, Germany, which is the closest big city, or Kassel, Germany, was going to be sort of like an 18-hour nightmare, it seemed. So I didn't. I may go back. I don't know. Because I want this picture. I want the picture of it in sunset light with light streaming out of the glass. But you can see at the very least, you know, the echo with the amount of glasswork and whatnot. And even though it's more stylized, the structure of the building is revealed, floor slabs, wall dividers, etc., which is, you know, a key element of European modernism. As I said, by 1914, Highland Park is regarded as obsolete. And so in 1915, Albert Kahn begins designing and building the Rouge Complex, which doesn't really get finished until well into the 20s. I have not yet been in the Rouge. I'm preparing to get down on hands and knees and beg the nice Ford PR people for a tour. But it was, at the time, in the late teens and 20s, the largest industrial conurbation in the world. So it even outdoes the Ruhr in Germany. And, of course, it's still there. It's still where we produce Ford automobiles. But most of what Albert Kahn built, not all, but most of it is gone. I thought I had a different picture here. Oh, no, I know where it is. Okay, so in any event, this is like 1915 and into the 20s. And this is a house on either Boston or Arden Place. I think it's Arden Place. Thank you. Yes, on the east side of Woodward. I don't know the name of this house. I just happened to like rush over to catch it when it was in sunset light one afternoon. But I think it's just, he built everything, especially in his early years. I mean, he went from Highland Park to this, from, you know, it's an astonishing thing. And, I mean, I would love to live in this house, which, by the way, appeared fairly well maintained, and I'm sure the cat would be a lovely addition. This is 1921. In 1915, I don't have a picture, but he builds the Detroit News Building, which I think it's a five-story building that is kind of very masculine and four square. It's an entire city block. It's sort of Romanesque in inspiration, lots of rounded arches. I liked the building a great deal. I worked there for 20 years. What I like in particular are the statues of the dead white guys that surround the pediment, and they're like big. They're, I think, a little larger than life size. Benjamin Franklin is one. And they have inspirational little comments next to them. But I don't, it's not my favorite of his buildings, so we don't have a good picture of it. This is General Motors, obviously, 1921. At the time that it was built, I believe the largest office building in the world. Very modern, sort of a city within a city. And a perfectly lovely place that I thought I had one more picture of, but I don't at this point. This is Angel Hall, which I believe I have. Hill Auditorium, thank you. You can't put something over on Ann Arbor audiences. Hill Auditorium, I believe, is 1922 or 23. That early, thank you. I really do have all these listed, and I don't have Hill on it, damn it. I love Hill Auditorium. It's one of my favorite buildings at the University of Michigan. Again, I think that it just excels at this sort of masculine heaviosity that Kahn wields very well. It is also, in some respects, a little bit like designs by Louis Sullivan, the great Chicago architect. But I love the way he has taken these, I think they're Doric or Tuscan columns, created this, you know, monochromatic entrance and then stuck it into this dark red brick building with a little tile bandings encircling the whole thing. I think it's a lovely building. Here we are back at General Motors. This was supposed to be in front of the previous picture. This I took from the top of the Argonaut building, which was the original General Motors design laboratory. It's a 13, I believe, story. Red brick Romanesque building right behind the GM building and the GM laboratories. And I was lucky enough to get up on the roof. And I love this. This, maybe we could say this is sort of Kahn at his most McKim, Mead, and White because of all the sort of neoclassical detailing on the top story. This is Clements Library, 1921. All right, back off. which Kahn said many times was his favorite building, his favorite design. It's based on a villa in Italy that I actually wanted to go visit but didn't. But I've looked at pictures of said villa, the name of which escapes me right now. This is much prettier. It's much more delicate. It's interesting for an architect who has this sort of weighty approach to a lot of his work. This is an elegant, simple little essay that I just think is great and is undergoing a massive renovation, so it should be spectacular once we get into it next year, I think. This is just the back corridor. Arty. Love the plants, love the vines. This is Angel Hall, which I believe is 1923. Thank you. Angel Hall is interesting. Angel Hall comes along right around the time that there's this kerfuffle in principally the alumni, but also to some extent among University of Michigan faculty. And a lovely woman whose name I'm blanking on wrote an essay for the LSNA magazine 15 or so years ago. Somebody know her name? Thank you, Janet Krieger. Lovely essay examining this kerfuffle and the... Well, basically, the attacks on Albert Kahn for designing buildings that looked like factories, which did not rise to the status of a great Midwestern land-grant university. And it got a little nasty. I've read some of the alumni magazine. It's fun stuff. And so Kahn, as I imagine, I mean, again, we don't have a diary where he lays this out, but as I imagine, he said basically, fine. I'll give you three plans for the facade of Angel Hall. And the first one looked a little bit like West Engineering, or more accurately, Natural Sciences. It's just a very simple sort of rectilinear gridwork, brick, academic building that we see on the diag. Then he gave them another design that was a little fancier than that. And then finally he gave them the Lincoln Memorial. And we know what they bid on. Now, here's the interesting thing, because the plans for Angel Hall was to be the gateway to the university. Doesn't that have a nice ring to it? But it's on State Street, And it's right across from other buildings. It's not like there's a road that terminates right in the middle of Angel Hall. That's what a gateway building is. This is a building on a linear strip that you never quite see the whole of. And I don't know what the trustees were thinking with the gateway stuff, because West Engineering, you could argue that's a little gateway. This is not a gateway. This is just a big, long building on a busy street. But I'm not criticizing it. I'm very fond of the big, long building on a busy street. And I love a lot of the detailing on Angel. There are a whole bunch of these little mythological, allegorical references scattered around the building. And, you know, the columns are great. Now, I said Lincoln Memorial. You will remember that Kahn traveled with Henry Bacon, who goes on to design the Lincoln Memorial. It's fair to assume that Kahn knew the Lincoln Memorial was built a few years before this, and that he had seen it. And so it perhaps is, among other things, an homage to a dear friend of his, which I think has a lovely sound too. By the way, the lobby right inside, this is beautiful, and I haven't gotten back yet to photograph it, but I can't wait. This is the Ford Rouge glass plant, 1925. So this is shortly after Angel Hall. Angel Hall gets built. He's already designing the glass plant. What I love about this is the sculptural quality to it. This is 1925. This is hyper-modern looking to me. I mean, it doesn't look dated at all. And I'm nuts about the parade of smokestacks in front of it, which is and was probably done just for purely practical reasons to organize them like that. I'm sure it was. But you see a similar thing on Highland Park, which had a parade of 5 smokestacks right facing Woodward with Ford suspended between them. The loss of those smokestacks is just a tragedy beyond the description. Kind of like the columns. Thank you. You see? Thank you. That's a lovely observation. So in any event, 1925, and it's just kind of flabbergasting. 1925 is also when the Free Press building goes up. This is one of my favorite Kahn buildings. I like it because it seems to me it's a sort of cross of Art Deco. You've got all these verticals going on. With a sort of arts and crafts, we have all of these little sculptural heads that we'll see up close up at the cornice line. I also love this traditional 1920s design of like sort of the 5 or 6 story base and then an absurdly narrow tower rising up on top of it. I think it's elegant. It is closed. It's empty. Some investors from China bought it, and I don't know that anyone knows what's going to happen to it, but I would be surprised if it isn't luxury condos within 5 years. And it's a lovely building. I'm actually quite a bit fonder of it than the Detroit News building. These are the guys. Now, I love this because the guy on top is very Roman looking, right? I mean, I think he's wearing a toga, for heaven's sakes. But the guys on either side are medieval. You know? And it's like, okay, who was working this line of reasoning out? But it's an absolutely delightful building. This is the house that Kahn built on Boston or Chicago for Senator Cousins, who'd been actually Detroit Mayor Cousins, and then Michigan Governor Cousins, and then Senator Cousins. It is a great building that is a ruin, unfortunately, but really very handsome. Which of us wouldn't be proud to live there? Those windows could be fixed up in no time. This is the Maccabees Building across from the Detroit Institute of Arts. It's 1927. We have an echo of the Free Press here in that we have sort of a base with a little stubby tower rising up off of it. I like the building a lot. I don't have a lot to say about it, except I was really glad that the clouds cooperated on this day to give a little drama to the background of the picture. And then, of course, we get to, you know, one of Kahn's clear masterworks, the Fisher Building in the New Center. Here, rising above a little arts and crafts house on Pallister Avenue in the sort of four-square but charming neighborhood immediately north of the Fisher Building, which General Motors renovated in the late 70s, I believe, like 100 houses or something. They're not Boston Edison, they're not fabulous mansions, but they're these four-square, very kind of cool houses. Once the M1 rail is finished and terminates at Grand Boulevard, right at the Fisher Building, these houses are going to be worth zillions. I looked into buying one. They're already expensive. But I just, you know, again, the Fisher Building, I think, is one of his iconic buildings that has a certain sort of power that exceeds the building itself. It's partly that it stands all by itself, so we see it everywhere. In that respect, it's a little bit like the late lamented World Trade Towers in New York, which you could see almost anywhere, so it seemed, from the five boroughs. You all know probably, but I will refresh your memories, that this was only supposed to be one third of a massive skyscraper complex. You can see the wing to the left appears to be reaching for something, and indeed it was reaching for a central tower that was going to be half again as high as the tower that we know as the Fisher Building. In other words, there's going to be this humongous middle tower, just stupefyingly large, especially in width. And then there was going to be an exact duplicate of the Fisher Building on the far end, the west end. See, we're going to have just unimaginably big complex. I mean, a Rockefeller Center plunked down right in Detroit. Unfortunately, the Fisher Building opens up in 1929, as did several zillion square feet of skyscraper space in Detroit, almost every big tower. It was 1928 or 1929. And obviously, the rest of it never got built. It says something about the design that this building has power, despite the fact that it's a truncated version of what it was supposed to be. All right, I will confess, I would have given it maybe two or three or four more stories. I think it's a little stubby. But then again, it was supposed to be a bookend for a much taller and perhaps more graceful building. I'm not saying this is ungraceful, by the way. And the new center is Albert Kahn's exercise in city building, because he builds the Fisher Building so elegantly disappearing in the fog just the other day. He builds the General Motors Building directly across the street from it. He builds the General Motors Laboratory, which is the low building with the red tile roof, which I love. And then he builds, at the far right, the Argonaut, which is this Romanesque-inspired early General Motors laboratory before they moved out of it. That red building, the Argonaut now, is now the Taubman Building at the College for Creative Studies, and it has been sumptuously renovated into a 300-kid dormitory, endless studio space, up-to-the-minute, artistic, photographic, you name it, whatnot, and an arts charter school on the ground floor. I mean, it's so cool. They did a really amazing job. And this, of course, is the interior of the Fisher Building with the beautiful ceiling and that parade of chandeliers. Love the vase placement there. We are very appreciative of that. Gives focus. And this is going back to the outside again. It's just, I mean, I love these three facades right next to one another. It's just, there's a tapestry here that's very cool. And this is the General Motors Laboratory. That's the Argonaut on the right. It's one of the most urban-feeling parts of Detroit. And it's a pity that more didn't get built around there, that it didn't end up being a true midtown, sort of a la New York, because even though Kahn built other buildings, including the Kahn Building behind or to the north of the Fisher Building, the area wants three or four more large buildings to really give it a sense that this is almost a satellite city. But again, I'm nuts about how the Fisher Building just sort of looms up everywhere and defines Detroit. This, by the way, was taken very close to the Lincoln Street Art Park on Lincoln Street just off Trumbull. If you want to see what grassroots rebellious artists are doing, go to the Lincoln Street Art Park. It is wicked cool. This is the William Livingston Lighthouse on Belle Isle, 1930. Very Art Deco. And again, I throw it in here just because, A, I'd never seen it. I didn't know he did a lighthouse. And it's elegant. And it actually contradicts my arguments about heavy, masculine, sort of, you know, stolid or ponderous architecture of a very high quality. This is just light and elegant. It is true that Albert Kahn himself didn't design every building that has his name. He ran an architecture firm that at one point had 600 people, engineers, architects, HVAC experts, you name it. What some people, the people who've done the 400 buildings in Detroit website, if you Google 400 buildings, Albert Kahn, it pulls up this marvelous website done by Michael Smith, and I'm blanking on the other fellow, which is just a listing of all the extant con stuff they could find in the Detroit area. The people at Con Associates, because of course the architecture firm still exists, recommended it to me and said they thought they did a very good job. But this is just, I mean, a lovely sort of light little element designed by I'm not sure who. There are two names that come to mind that are very important. One is Ernest Wilby, who ends up teaching at the University of Michigan and is responsible for a lot of the beauty in Con's, especially I think teens and 20s projects. Also Wirt Rowland, R-O-W-L-A-N-D, who's more famous now for designing the Guardian Building and the Buell Building and the Penobscot Building all right together downtown. And he worked for Smith Grills and Hinchman, or Smith Hinchman and Grills, I can never keep it straight. But he worked for Albert Kahn for a while. What the people who did the 400 buildings in Detroit argue is that Kahn was gifted, and people say, and you read this in the documentary record, that he was involved with everything that came out of his office. But the scale got stupefying by the mid to late 30s, and just stupefying. But he had a talent for hiring talented architects. Though, for many years, he wouldn't hire anyone with a graduate degree in architecture because he thought they were all just show-off little artistes who would not stoop to the practical element of architecture, which he famously said, and you've probably heard this, architecture is 90% business and 10% art. And that was his approach. Another reason why European modernists later in the century may have kind of sneered at him. I don't know if this is Corrado Parducci, okay? I have looked it up. I didn't look it up for this. Corrado Parducci is the sculptor who does a lot of the decorative work on Kahn and other buildings in the 20s and 30s. But it's lovely all the same. And then we get to Burton Memorial Tower, 1936, which, again, is another, I think, iconic Kahn building that sort of defines an entire town. We can see it from everywhere. And I think does have, again, this kind of heavy masculine quality, even in an Art Deco building, of great simplicity. There was actually a design for a similar Carillon Tower by Eliel Saarinen, the Cranbrook school designer, that was going to be attached to an adjacent music school, and that does not get built, though some people feel the telescoping nature of the top of this is sort of an homage to Saarinen, that the two were friends. God, I love telephoto lenses. And finally, God, can you believe it? He's actually wrapping up. This is the Dodge half-ton truck plant, 1938. So this is 4 years before his death. And again, my feeling on this is like, dear God, this is modern sculpture. And for the 30s in the United States, this just seems blisteringly modern. This was on 8 Mile Road in Warren, and as far as I could tell driving around an hour and a half months ago, there's no piece of it left, which I think is just such a tragedy. Now, Kahn gets slammed by all these people who write art books about the 20th century and 20th century architecture, and most of them leave him out rather nastily, although Vincent Scully makes a reference to Kahn's beautiful factories. But there's a huge tome like this that called American Art in the 20th Century. And he, the author whose name escapes me, uses a picture of this half-ton plant as the frontispage for his essay on modern architecture. So he gets some credit. All right, very quickly. So he invents modern architecture. Wow, what a guy. He invents the daylight humane factory, even though Henry Ford may have subverted that. So it goes. He saves the Diego Rivera murals at the Detroit Institute of Arts, and he wins World War II for the Allies. Because, although he was too old to serve, although I can certainly see him going off, his son, Eddie, who became was a neurosurgeon and became the head of neurosurgery at the University of Michigan Hospital for many, many years. I was going someplace with that. Where was I going? Thank you, he saves the world. His son did serve in the war and actually knew his father had, could tell his father had congestive heart failure because his father complained about not being able to sleep at night and whatnot. And according to a lovely family biography by a guy named Bradshaw, that's his last name, who is a grandson-in-law, says that Eddie Kahn knew when he hugged his father that he'd never see him again. You know, and one can only imagine these things. Not only did Kahn build nearly every car factory in the United States for much of the early 20th century, and companies that we've totally forgotten about, Chalmers, Continental, you name it, but he also built 521 factories in the Soviet Union from 1929 to 1931. He was a significant part of the first five-year plan in the Soviet Union. I studied Soviet history a lot in college. I love this. Henry Ford was already invested in the Soviet Union. And Kahn's argument was that helping any people industrialize, no matter what their form of government, is good for the world at large and good for humanity at large. He builds these, designs and builds these 521 factories. He establishes a branch office in Moscow that his brother Moritz, or Moritz, runs for many years, well, for 2 years. They only back out once the Soviets finally said, no, what if now we just pay you in rubles? Let's stop this dollar silliness. And the Kahn firm was very sensible and stepped back. There were other foreigners who built industrial infrastructure in the Soviet Union, but 521 factories in a country that in 1925 was not industrial at all is a huge percentage. You will all remember the Soviets won the war for us. The Battle of Stalingrad is it. The tractor factories that were turned over to war production were mostly Kahn factories. And this didn't escape the notice of some British generals who remark at various points that Detroit won the war and that Albert Kahn won the war. And so I think we owe him a great deal of debt and gratitude. And thank you so much. I thought this was going to be wrapped up in like 40 minutes. I'm sorry to dribble on so long. I'm happy. Oh, wait. There's more excitement to come. Very quickly, now we move into the filthy commerce section. I have my Way Cool Detroit Architecture postcard sets. We have for sale. They're $5 a set. You get 6 different postcards. This is my Detroit Pretty set. I designed these in 2010 and published them myself, shot them and published them long before it was fashionable to say Detroit was beautiful. I'm very proud of that. And this is my Detroit Gritty set. And I would say that I do not think this constitutes ruin porn because I have not tried to make these buildings look ugly. I've tried to make them look beautiful. And I think that collapsed early 20th century industrial forms, which you find in most American cities somewhere, are beautiful often because of their geometry. So those are for sale. They're each $5 a piece. And then my book, Michigan's Historic Railroad Stations, which is sort of a love song to the design of train stations in the state. So, there, we'll go back to Albert Kahn. All right, if there are any questions, you're going to have to wait for a microphone to reach you since we are being taped.
Yes, I'm right back here. So if you have a question, right over here.
Yeah, first a comment. The Maccabee Building was the home of the Lone Ranger radio show.
Oh my God, that's great. Yeah.
And I remember back about 30 years ago, the Detroit Institute of Arts had an exhibit on Albert Kahn. I'm not sure if you're aware of that or not, but yeah. I do have the catalog from the show.
Yeah, The Legacy of Albert Kahn by Ferry, blanking on his first name. Yeah, it's a lovely book. The University of Michigan Museum of Art also had a show on Kahn, I think in the 90s, called Albert Kahn, Inspiration for the Modern, and they published a lovely catalog with several really interesting essays by people who have made Albert Kahn their life's work.
You mentioned Mies a couple of different times, and how much of a relationship was there? What did Mies get from Kahn or Kahn from Mies, do you think?
Mies designs a concert hall in the 40s, early 40s, I think, and he uses the Chrysler half-ton plant as a framework for it and designs a concert hall within this sort of rough outline of a Kahn factory. So that was sort of the most obvious acknowledgement. But beyond that, I think that, you know, Mises' stuff has that sort of rectilinear simplicity to it, which feels very Kahn-like to me, at least. But as I should have warned you beforehand, I'm no architectural historian. I'm merely a layperson dabbling in this stuff. So there may be other arguments as well. But I see that connection. And Mies speaks well of Kahn on occasion. I've looked up dozens and dozens of biographies of Gropius, like Corbusier, Mies van der Rohe, Yamasaki, all these people, just to look in the index of every biography. Does he mention Kahn? Which has been an interesting way of getting comment on his work. By the way, Wilhelm Valentiner, the pioneering curator who built the Detroit Institute of Arts from 1927 on, is responsible in large part for the Diego Rivera murals and all the great art before 1950 that the museum gets, very much admired Kahn's work, like very much admired it. Okay, who next? We got someone up here. Microphone racing to you.
About 43, 45 years ago, I used to work in the Fisher Building, and it was a joy, truly, every day, even at that young age at that time, to go into the building. I loved it. And, of course, not realizing anything about Kahn at the time. But my question is, he built the building, but what about the ceilings inside, the beautiful murals and things that are on the ceiling? Were those his ideas, or where did they come from?
And some of that I haven't researched in depth yet. So I know that, for instance, the design work on the elevator doors is Corrado Parducci, the sculptor. He does not do the other 3D stuff on the building, though. And he clearly has a relationship with Albert Kahn, and in fact, on some of Kahn's drawings, there are notations, I'm told by the guys who did the website 400 Buildings of Albert Kahn, there are notations on some rough drawings that just say, Corrado will do something here. So, you know, I don't know whether or not the ceiling work at the Fisher Building was done out of Kahn's office or was subcontracted to, you know, graphic designers or painters or sculptors. But you can be pretty sure that Kahn knew what was going on. And approved of that subcontracting, if that's the way it worked. But it's a good question. I was hoping nobody would ask. Because there are lots of little details like this where it's like, oh, God, that's right, I haven't researched this. Oh, geez, I have to do that. We'll get to it. Thank you. Anyone else?
You mentioned that there were cottages.
Sorry. You mentioned that there were cottages that were built across the street from the
Packard plant, but not by Albert Kahn. They just
were they specifically for the employees of the factory, or it was just a good thing for people to live there and just cross the street?
They were not like all the same.
Okay.
So it didn't look like Packard went in and built, you know, 50 or 100 houses. But I've seen pictures of the early Packard plant, and it's surrounded by fields.
Right.
So I think it's just real estate speculation throws up all these different little houses.
Because in a lot of the cotton mills in New England, there were mill villages that were built around them.
So I don't think that was the case here. At least I haven't read any references to it. I live on Mulholland Street near 7th, right off Liberty and Washington, steep little street, Murray and Mulholland. And those were sort of factory housing that were all built alike. For whatever factory, I think it was one of those, a camera or, yeah. Yes. On, oh, how cool.
Oh, sorry.
Identify yourself, please.
Oh, sorry. Actually fairly shy, and I don't usually ask questions of these sorts of things, but I have this certain thing about Mulholland that they were built probably by the same people because they're all like the same or mirror images. But if you look in the old city directories, the people have a variety of jobs. They didn't work at a specific factory.
And they pop up, yeah, okay.
Yeah. Just for the record. Nothing to do with Kahn.
They're sweet streets. As a matter of fact, before I moved to Ann Arbor, 100 years ago, a friend who's now a landscape architect in Maine gave me, in like 1979, this lovely book from the National Trust called America's Forgotten Architecture. It was this beautiful picture book of the sort that I aspire to do and fall short of vernacular design. I mean, in the late 70s, we were still rediscovering that. It seems a little old hat now, but, you know, industry and little cottages and fence posts and whatnot. There's a little picture of Murray Street in Ann Arbor, the Murray Street Historic District. And when I moved here, I was like, oh, my God. It was very exciting.
I think we have time for just one more question, if that's all right. Anyone else? No? Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming.
I will be selling my wares. These are stocking stuffers. And thank you so much. Give yourself a